had 37 grams of saturated fat. So what? Is that good or bad? Art Silverman of the CSPI cleverly placed the popcorn's saturated fat content in a relevant context for comparison. He said that one bag of popcorn was equivalent to a whole day's worth of unhealthy eating. Silverman knew that most people would be appalled by this finding. What if Silverman had been a sleazebag? He could have picked a food item that was notoriously unhealthy but relatively low in saturated fat, such as lollipops. One bag of popcorn has the fat equivalent of 712,000 lollipops. Or an infinite number of lollipops since they're fat-free. This statistic is sleazy because it draws its power from sleight of hand involving different senses of unhealthy food. A sleazy movie theater executive to retaliate might have changed the domain of comparison from saturated fat to some positive attribute of corn. A bag of popcorn has as much vitamin J as 71 pounds of broccoli. We made this up. These possibilities are examples of why writing about statistics filled us with anxiety. Particularly in the realm of politics, tinkering with statistics provides lucrative employment for untold numbers of issue advocates. Ethically challenged people with lots of analytical smarts can, with enough contortions, make almost any case from a given set of statistics. Of course, let's also remember that it's easier to lie without statistics than with them. Data enforces boundaries. Unless people are unethical enough to make up data, the reality of the data constrains them. That's a good thing, but it still leaves a lot of wiggle room. So what about the rest of us, who aren't spinmeisters? What do we do? We will still be tempted to put the best possible spin on our statistics. All of us do it. I scored 16 points for the church basketball team tonight. Not mentioned, 22 missed shots and the loss of the game. I'm 5'6". Not mentioned, the 3-inch heels. Revenue was up 10% this year, so I think I deserve a bonus. Not mentioned, profits tanked. When it comes to statistics, our best advice is to use them as input, not output. Use them to make up your mind on an issue. Don't make up your mind and then go looking for the numbers to support yourself. That's asking for temptation and trouble. But if we use the statistics to help us make up our minds, we'll be in a great position to share the pivotal numbers with others, as did Jeff Ainscow and the Beyond War supporters. Clinic. Dealing with shark attack hysteria. The situation. Every few years, the media go frothy over shark attacks. Shark attacks, however, remain extremely rare and do not vary much from one year to the next. So why do they consume so much media and public attention? The answer is that shark attacks spawn terrifying, dream-haunting stories like the following from the Oprah Winfrey Show. Oprah. Bethany Hamilton loved to ride the waves. Surfing daily since she was 8 years old, Bethany was such a phenom, people said she had salt water running through her veins. At the young age of 13, Bethany was a rising star on the surfing circuit and had become a local celebrity. But what happened next landed Bethany in headlines around the world. It was early morning. Bethany was in the ocean lying on her board with her arm dangling in the water. Suddenly, a deadly 15-foot tiger shark seized her arm. Violently, he jerked and yanked it until her arm was ripped right off of her small body. Seconds later, the shark and her entire arm were gone, and Bethany was left alone on her board, surrounded by bloody water. Imagine that you are forced to combat these vivid stories. Maybe you're the publicity director of the Save the Sharks Foundation, or maybe you're trying to convince your junior high school daughter that it's okay to go to the beach. How do you do it? You've got the truth on your side. Attacks are very rare. But that's no guarantee that people will believe you. So what source of credibility do you tap to get people to believe you? Message 1. We base this message on statistics published by the Florida Museum of Natural History. You're more likely to drown on a beach in an area protected by a lifeguard than you are to be attacked by a shark, much less killed by one. In the United States in 2000, 12 people died in lifeguard-protected areas. There were no fatalities from sharks. In a typical year, there are only 0.4 fatalities. Comments on message 1. This is okay, but not great. This message taps internal credibility, the credibility of hard statistics. We have 2 comments. First, drowning does not seem like the right comparison to make because many people may think drowning is a common cause of death. Drowning is more common than shark attacks. Does not feel particularly unexpected. And maybe we're too skeptical, but the presence of the college student lifeguard never struck us as an ironclad guarantee of safety. Second, the statistical comparison, 12 deaths versus 0.4, is good, but it isn't particularly vivid or meaningful on a human scale. It's unlikely that anyone would remember these numbers a week later. Message 2. This message is also based on statistics published by the Florida Museum of Natural History. Which of these animals is more likely to kill you? A shark? A deer? Answer. The deer is more likely to kill you. In fact, it's 300 times more likely to kill you via a collision with your car. Comments on message 2. We like the unexpected idea that Bambi is more dangerous than the evil shark, followed by the doubly unexpected statistic that Bambi is wildly more dangerous, 300 times more deadly. It's absurd to the point of being funny, and humor is a nice antidote to the fear generated by shark attack stories. In a sense, we're fighting emotional associations with emotional associations. See the next chapter. This message taps internal credibility with a statistic, but it also taps into the audience as a source of credibility. People in the audience know how much they fear deer when they're driving around, i.e., not much. Few of us are afraid to go out in the evening on account of lurking deer. We know that we don't fear deer, so why should we fear sharks? This is more effective than comparing shark attacks with drowning. After all, most of us have at least a mild fear of drowning. Punchline. When we use statistics, the less we rely on the actual numbers, the better. The numbers inform us about the underlying relationship, but there are better ways to illustrate the underlying relationship than the numbers themselves. Juxtaposing the deer and the shark is similar to Inskow's use of BBs in a bucket. The Sinatra Test and Safe Express. We've seen that we can make our ideas more credible on their own merits by using compelling details or by using statistics. A third way to develop internal credibility is to use a particular type of example, an example that passes what we call the Sinatra Test. In Frank Sinatra's classic, New York, New York, he sings about starting a new life in New York City, and the chorus declares, "If I can make it there, I'll make it anywhere." An example passes the Sinatra Test when one example alone is enough to establish credibility in a given domain. For instance, if you've got the security contract for Fort Knox, you're in the running for any security contract, even if you have no other clients. If you catered a White House function, you can compete for any catering contract. It's the Sinatra Test. If you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. Safe Express, a family-owned business based in India, used the Sinatra Test to its advantage. Safe Express competes in the shipping business, where competition is fierce. And while the competition led to low prices, there was a catch. Most shipping firms would not guarantee safe, on-time deliveries. With some firms, you couldn't be guaranteed that deliveries would be made ever. To distinguish itself from the competition, Safe Express assured its customers of safe, on-time delivery. International companies operating in India, companies accustomed to the reliability of FedEx, embraced Safe Express immediately. But Safe Express struggled to attract business from Indian companies that weren't accustomed to paying higher rates. Rubal Jain, a member of the founding family of Safe Express, was determined to make inroads with Indian companies. To do so, Jayan set his sights on winning the account of a major Bollywood studio. When Jayan proposed that Safe Express distribute the studio's films, the reaction was, "Are you kidding?" The skepticism was predictable and plausible. Piracy is a major concern in India, as it is in the rest of the world. So distribution is mission critical. If films end up misplaced en route, bootlegged versions show up a few weeks later on street corners. This risk wasn't one that the movie studio could take. Fortunately, Jayan had a powerful credential ready. Safe Express had handled the release of the fifth Harry Potter book. Every Potter book and every bookstore in India had been delivered there by Safe Express, an insanely complicated delivery. All the books had to arrive in stores by 8 a.m. on the morning of the release. Not too early, or the bookstore owners might try to sell them early, and the secret would be blown. And not too late, or the bookstore owners would be irate at lost sales. Also, the Potter books needed the same piracy protections as the studio films. There could be no leaks. And Jayan had a second story. He knew from an earlier conversation that the Bollywood studio executive had a brother who had recently taken his high school board exams. After telling the Harry Potter story, Jayan mentioned, "By the way, we also safely delivered the examination papers for your brother's boards and carried the return answer sheets." Safe Express handles the distribution of all the central examinations for high school and university admissions. 2 months later, the deal was signed. Both of Jayan's stories passed the Sinatra test. Jayan could have used statistics instead of stories. 98.84% of our deliveries arrive on time. Or he could have drawn on an external source of credibility, such as a testimonial from the CEO of a multinational company. "We've used Safe Express for all our deliveries in India, and we've found them to be an excellent service provider." Both of these are good credibility boosters. But there is something extraordinary about being the company that carries completed board exams and the latest Harry Potter book. Their power comes from their concreteness, rather than from numbers or authority. These stories make you think, if Safe Express can make it there, they can make it anywhere. Edible fabrics. For an example that unites all three of the internal credibility sources, details, statistics, and the Sinatra test, we can turn to Bill McDonough, an environmentalist known for helping companies improve both the environment and the bottom line. Most executives tend to be skeptical and suspicious when approached by an environmentalist, even a business-friendly environmentalist like McDonough. To overcome such skepticism, to prove that there can be perfect consistency between business goals and environmental goals, McDonough tells a story that passes the Sinatra test. As the story goes, in 1993, McDonough and a chemist, Michael Braungart, were hired by the Swiss textile manufacturer Rohner Textil, which produces the fabrics for steel-case chairs. Their mission was one that most people in the textile industry considered impossible: creating a manufacturing process without using toxic chemicals. The textile industry routinely deals with hazardous chemicals. Most dye colors contain toxic elements. In fact, the trimmings from Rohner Textil's factory, the excess cloth not used on the chairs, contained so many questionable chemicals that the Swiss government classified them as hazardous waste. Furthermore, the trimmings couldn't be buried or burned in Switzerland. To comply with government regulations, they had to be exported, shipped to a country with laxer regulations, such as Spain. Note the vivid concrete detail. McDonough said, "If your trimmings are declared hazardous waste, but you can sell what's in the middle, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to know you're selling hazardous waste." To tackle this problem, eliminating toxic chemicals from the furniture manufacturing process, McDonough needed to find a willing partner in the chemical industry. He had to provide Rohner Textil with a source for clean chemicals that would fit the company's production needs. So he and Braungart started approaching executives in the chemical industry. They said, We'd like to see all products in the future be as safe as pediatric pharmaceuticals. We'd like our babies to be able to suck on them and get health and not sickness. They asked chemical factories to open their books and talk about how the chemicals were manufactured. McDonough told the companies, "Don't tell us it's proprietary and legal. If we don't know what it is, we're not using it." 60 chemical companies turned them down. Finally, the chairman of one firm, Siba Geigy, said okay. McDonough and Braungart studied 8,000 chemicals commonly used in the textile industry. They measured each chemical against a set of safety criteria. Of the chemicals they tested, 7,962 failed. They were left with 38 chemicals, but those 38 were safe enough to eat, according to McDonough. Note the concrete detail, safe enough to eat, plus a statistic that establishes a relationship. A tiny number of good chemicals out of a larger number of toxic chemicals. Amazingly, using just those 38 chemicals, they were able to create a complete line of fabrics containing every color but black. The fabric they chose was made from natural materials, wool and a plant fiber called rayme. When the production process went online, inspectors from the Swiss government came to check the water flowing out of the plant to make sure chemical emissions were within legal limits. At first, the inspectors thought their equipment had broken, McDonough says. The instruments were detecting nothing in the water. Then the inspectors tested the water flowing into the factory, which was Swiss drinking water, and found that the equipment was fine. McDonough says, "The fabrics during the production process were further filtering the water." McDonough's new process wasn't just safer, it was cheaper. Manufacturing costs shrank 20%. The savings came in part from the reduced hassle and expense of dealing with toxic chemicals. Workers no longer had to wear protective clothing, and the scraps, instead of being shipped off to Spain for burial, were converted into felt, which was sold to Swiss farmers and gardeners for crop insulation. This story is remarkable. Think about all the memorable elements. The impossible mission. The elimination of all but 38 of 8,000 chemicals. The factory's water turned so clean that Swiss inspectors thought their instruments were broken. The scraps were transformed from hazardous waste into crop insulation. The idea that this fabric was safe enough to eat, and the happy business result, workers made safer and costs down 20%. If McDonough approaches any business in any industry with a suggestion for a more environment-friendly process, this story will give him enormous credibility. It easily clears the bar set by the Sinatra test. So far, we've talked about creating credibility by drawing on external sources, authorities and anti-authorities. And we've talked about creating credibility by drawing on sources inside the message itself, by using details and statistics and examples that pass the Sinatra test. But there's one remaining source of credibility that we haven't discussed, and it may be the most powerful source of all. Where is the beef? One of the most brilliant television ad campaigns of all time was launched by Wendy's in 1984. The first commercial opens on three elderly women standing together at a counter. On the counter, there's a hamburger on a plate, and they're gawking at it because it's huge, about a foot in diameter. "It certainly is a big bun," says the woman on the left. "A very big bun," echoes the one in the center. "A big fluffy bun," says the first. "A very big fluffy..." There's a pause as the woman in the middle lifts the top half of the bun and reveals a meager, overcooked beef patty and a single pickle. The patty is dwarfed by the bun. For the first time, we hear from the woman on the right, played by 80-year-old Clara Peller. She squints through her glasses and says cantankerously, "Where's the beef?" The announcer says, "Some hamburger places give you a lot less beef on a fluffy bun." Peller, "Where's the beef?" Announcer, "The Wendy's single has more beef than the Whopper or the Big Mac. At Wendy's, you get more beef and less bun." Peller, "Hey, where's the beef?" She peers over the counter. I don't think there's anybody back there. There's a lot to love about these commercials. They're funny and well-produced. Clara Peller became a minor celebrity. More remarkably, the ads highlighted a true advantage of Wendy's hamburgers. They really did have more beef. The ads were a refreshing departure from the standard advertiser toolkit that attempts to paint powerful but irrelevant emotions on consumer goods. For instance, associating a mother's love of her children with a particular brand of fabric softener. Wendy's did something more admirable. It highlighted a genuine advantage of its product and presented it in an enjoyable way. The ads had a big impact. According to polls taken by Wendy's, the number of customers who believed that Wendy's single was larger than the Whopper or the Big Mac increased by 47% in the 2 months after the commercial aired. During the first full year after the ads ran, Wendy's revenues rose 31%. The claim Wendy's had made was that its burgers had more beef. This information was probably not something most people would have given much thought to before. Certainly it was not common sense at the time. So how did Wendy's make this claim credible? Notice that something different is going on here. This message doesn't draw on external credibility. Wendy's didn't invite Larry Bird to weigh in on burger sizes. Nor did it use an anti-authority, like an obese burger-eating giant. It doesn't draw on internal credibility, either, quoting a statistic like, 11% more beef. Instead, the commercials developed a brand new source of credibility, the audience. Wendy's outsourced its credibility to its customers. The spots implicitly challenged customers to verify Wendy's claims. See for yourself. Look at our burgers versus McDonald's burgers. You'll notice the size difference. To use scientific language, Wendy's made a falsifiable claim. Any customer with a ruler and a scale could have verified the claim's truth value, though Wendy's advantage was sufficiently substantial that just eyeballing the difference was enough. This challenge, asking customers to test a claim for themselves, is a testable credential. Testable credentials can provide an enormous credibility boost, since they essentially allow your audience members to try before they buy. Testable credentials. Testable credentials have a colorful history in urban legends. In the 1990s, Snapple struggled to shake rumors that it supported the Ku Klux Klan. Rumor mongers thought they had a few pieces of evidence on their side. Look on any bottle of Snapple. There's a picture of a slave ship on the front. Doubters were also encouraged to look for the strange symbol showing a K inside a circle, allegedly evidence of the Klan's ownership. Sure enough, Snapple's labels did feature a picture of a ship and a K in a circle. They just had nothing to do with the Klan. The ship was from an engraving of the Boston Tea Party. The circled K is a symbol for kosher. But some uninformed people saw these symbols and bought into the rumors. Notice that the Snapple rumor provides a kind of bait-and-switch version of where's the beef. Wendy's says, see for yourself. Our burgers have more beef. The rumor mongers say, see for yourself. There's a circled K. Therefore, Snapple supports the Ku Klux Klan. The validity of the see-for-yourself claim causes some people to leap, illogically, to the rumor monger's conclusion. This is how testable credentials can backfire. The see-for-yourself step can be valid, while the resulting conclusion can be entirely invalid. Testable credentials are useful in many domains. For example, take the question, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? Ronald Reagan famously posed this question to the audience during his 1980 presidential debate with Jimmy Carter. Reagan could have focused on statistics, the high inflation rate, the loss of jobs, the rising interest rates. But instead of selling his case, he deferred to his audience. Another example of testable credentials comes from Jim Thompson, the founder of the Positive Coaching Alliance, PCA. The mission of the PCA is to emphasize that youth sports should not be about winning at all costs. It should be about learning life lessons. The PCA holds positive coaching seminars for youth sports coaches. At the seminars, trainers use the analogy of an emotional tank to get coaches to think about the right ratio of praise, support, and critical feedback. The emotional tank is like the gas tank of an automobile. If your car's tank is empty, you can't drive very far. If your emotional tank is empty, you are not going to be able to perform at your best. After the emotional tank analogy is introduced, the trainers begin an exercise. First, they ask the coaches to imagine that the person next to them has just flubbed a key play in the game. The coaches are challenged to say something to the person to drain his emotional tank. Since clever put-downs are a staple of many sports interactions, this exercise is embraced with noticeable enthusiasm. Thompson says, "The room fills with laughter as coaches get into the exercise, sometimes with great creativity." Then the coaches are asked to imagine that someone else has made the same mistake, but now they're in charge of filling that person's emotional tank instead of draining it. This generates a more muted response. Thompson says, "The room often gets very quiet, and you finally hear a feeble, nice try." Observing their own behavior, the coaches learn the lesson. How they found it easier to criticize than to support. To think of 10 clever insults rather than a single consolation. Thompson found a way to transform his point into a testable credential. Something the coaches could experience for themselves. Clinic. Our intuition is flawed. But who wants to believe that? The situation. People often trust their intuition, but our intuition is flawed by identifiable biases. Still, most people feel pretty good about their intuition, and it's hard to convince them otherwise. This is the uphill battle faced by psychologists who study decision-making. Pretend that you're the editor of an introductory psychology textbook, and you're looking at two competing ways of explaining the concept of availability bias. Message 1. Get ready to make a few predictions. Which of the following events kill more people? Homicide or suicide? Floods or tuberculosis? Tornadoes or asthma? Take a second to think about your answers. You might have thought that homicide, floods, and tornadoes are more common. People generally do. But in the United States, there are 50% more deaths from suicide than from homicide, 9 times more deaths from tuberculosis than from floods, and 80 times more deaths from asthma than from tornadoes. So why do people predict badly? Because of the availability bias. The availability bias is a natural tendency that causes us, when estimating the probability of a particular event, to judge the event's probability by its availability in our memory. We intuitively think that events are more likely when they are easier to remember. But often the things we remember are not an accurate summary of the world. We may remember things better because they evoke more emotion, not because they are more frequent. We may remember things better because the media spend more time covering them, perhaps because they provide more vivid images, not because they are more common. The availability bias may lead our intuition astray, prompting us to treat unusual things as common and unlikely things as probable. Comments on Message 1. This passage uses a simple but effective testable credential. Which problem do you think kills more people? With any luck, readers will botch at least one of the predictions, thus illustrating for themselves the reality of the availability bias. Message 2. Here's an alternative passage illustrating the availability bias that is more typical of introductory textbooks. The availability bias is a natural tendency that causes us, when estimating the probability of a particular event, to judge the event's probability by its availability in our memory. We intuitively think that events are more likely when they're easier to remember, but often the things we remember are not an accurate summary of the world. For example, in a study by decision researchers at the University of Oregon, experimental participants thought that 20% more people died in homicides than in suicides, when the truth is that there are 50% more deaths from suicides. Subjects thought that more people were killed by floods than tuberculosis, but 9 times more people are killed by tuberculosis. Subjects believed that approximately as many people were killed by tornadoes as by asthma, but there are 80 times more deaths from asthma. People remember things better because they evoke more emotion, not because they are more frequent. People remember things better because the media spend more time covering them, perhaps because they provide more vivid images, not because they are more common. The availability bias may lead our intuition astray, prompting us to treat unusual things as common and unlikely things as probable. Comments on message 2. This is less involving. You can imagine a student reading the second paragraph, which gives away the punchline that asthma kills 80 times more people than tornadoes, and thinking, wow, those research participants were dumb. It's much more powerful to experience the effect for yourself. Punchline. Using testable credentials allows people to try out an idea for themselves. Rookie orientation. Let's shift to a different sports domain, the National Basketball Association. Imagine that it's your job to educate incoming NBA rookies about the danger of AIDS. NBA players are young men. Rookies are often under 21. And they are sudden celebrities, with all the attention that goes with this new fame. They've heard about AIDS their entire lives, so the risk is not that they're unaware of AIDS. The risk is that the circumstances of their lives prompt them to drop their guard for a night. How do you make the threat of AIDS credible and immediate? Think through the possible sources of credibility. You could draw on external credibility, a celebrity expert like Magic Johnson, or an anti-authority, such as an athlete in the terminal stages of AIDS. You could use statistics on a human scale, perhaps the odds of contracting AIDS from a single encounter with a stranger. You could use vivid details. An athlete could recount how his normal safe-sex vigilance was eroded by a particularly wild night of partying. Any of these could be quite effective. But what if you wanted to move the source of credibility inward, inside the heads of the players? The NBA came up with an ingenious way to do just that. A few weeks before the NBA season begins, all the rookie players are required to meet in Tarrytown, New York, for a mandatory orientation session. They're essentially locked in a hotel for 6 days. No pagers, no cell phones. The rookies are taught about life in the big leagues. Everything from how to deal with the media to how to make sensible investments with their new riches. One year, despite the secrecy surrounding the orientation, a group of female fans staked out the location. On the first night of the orientation, they were hanging out in the hotel bar and restaurant, dressed to be noticed. The players were pleased by the attention. There was a lot of flirting, and the players made plans to meet up with some of the women later in the orientation. The next morning, the rookies dutifully showed up for their session. They were surprised to see the female fans in front of the room. The women introduced themselves again, one by one. Hi, I'm Sheila, and I'm HIV positive. Hi, I'm Donna, and I'm HIV positive. Suddenly, the talk about AIDS clicked for the rookies. They saw how life could get out of control, how a single night could cause a lifetime of regret. Contrast the NBA's approach with the NFL's approach. At the NFL's orientation one year, league personnel had every rookie put a condom on a banana. No doubt eye-rolling was epidemic. Later, two women, former football groupies, talked about how they would try to seduce players, hoping to get pregnant. The women's session was powerful. It was a well-designed message. But what's more likely to stick with someone? Hearing about someone who fooled someone else or being fooled yourself? How do we get people to believe our ideas? We've got to find a source of credibility to draw on. Sometimes the wellsprings are dry, as Barry Marshall discovered in his quest to cure the ulcer. Drawing on external credibility didn't work. The endorsement of his supervisors and his institution in Perth didn't seem to be enough. Drawing on internal credibility didn't work. His careful marshalling of data and detail still didn't help him clear the bar. In the end, what he did was draw on the audience's credibility. He essentially modeled a testable credential by gulping a glass of bacteria. The implicit challenge was, see for yourself. If you drink this gunk, you'll get an ulcer just like I did. It's not always obvious which wellspring of credibility we should draw from. What Marshall showed so brilliantly was perseverance, knowing when it was time to draw on a different well. In this chapter, we've seen that the most obvious sources of credibility, external validation and statistics, aren't always the best. A few vivid details might be more persuasive than a barrage of statistics. An anti-authority might work better than an authority. A single story that passes the Sinatra test might overcome a mountain of skepticism. It's inspirational to know that a medical genius like Marshall had to climb over the same hurdles with his idea as we'll have to climb with ours, and to see that he eventually prevailed to the benefit of us all. Chapter 5. Emotional. Mother Teresa once said, "If I look at the mass, I will never act. If I look at the one, I will." In 2004, some researchers at Carnegie Mellon University decided to see whether most people act like Mother Teresa. The researchers wanted to see how people responded to an opportunity to make a charitable contribution to an abstract cause versus a charitable contribution to a single person. They offered participants $5 to complete a survey about their usage of various technology products. The survey was irrelevant. The point was to ensure that the participants would have some cash on hand to consider donating to charity. When people finished the survey, they received their payment in five $1 bills. They also received, unexpectedly, an envelope and a charity request letter, giving them an opportunity to donate some of their money to Save the Children, a charity that focuses on the well-being of children worldwide. The researchers tested two versions of the request letter. The first version featured statistics about the magnitude of the problems facing children in Africa, such as the following. Food shortages in Malawi are affecting more than 3 million children. In Zambia, severe rainfall deficits have resulted in a 42% drop in maize production from 2000. As a result, an estimated 3 million Zambians face hunger. 4 million Angolans, one-third of the population, have been forced to flee their homes. More than 11 million people in Ethiopia need immediate food assistance. The other version of the letter gave information about a single young girl. Any money that you donate will go to Rokia, a 7-year-old girl from Mali, Africa. Rokia is desperately poor and faces the threat of severe hunger or even starvation. Her life will be changed for the better as a result of your financial gift. With your support and the support of other caring sponsors, Save the Children will work with Rokia's family and other members of the community to help feed and educate her and provide basic medical care and hygiene education. The researchers gave participants one of the two different letters, then left them alone. They chose how much money, if any, to put back into the envelope. Then they sealed the envelope and handed it back to a researcher. On average, the people who read the statistics contributed $1.14. The people who read about Rokia contributed $2.38, more than twice as much. It seems that most people have something in common with Mother Teresa. When it comes to our hearts, one individual trumps the masses. The researchers believed that the smaller donations for the statistical letter could be a result of what they called the drop-in-the-bucket effect. If people felt overwhelmed by the scale of the problem, their small donations might have seemed meaningless. But here's where things get even more interesting. The researchers decided to give a third group of people both sets of information, the statistics and the story about Rukia. The researchers wondered whether people who got all the information would give more, on average, than the $2.38 that had been given by the Rukia group. Perhaps the combination of statistics and stories, the power of individual need coupled with the statistical scale of the problem, would inspire a whole new level of giving. Nope. The people who received both letters gave $1.43, almost a dollar less than the people who got the Rukia story alone. Somehow, these statistics, evidence of massive human suffering in Africa, actually made people less charitable. What was going on? The researchers theorized that thinking about statistics shifts people into a more analytical frame of mind. When people think analytically, they're less likely to think emotionally. And the researchers believed it was people's emotional response to Rukia's plight that led them to act. To prove this argument, they ran a second study. In this study, they primed some people to think in an analytical way by asking questions such as, if an object travels at 5 feet per minute, then by your calculations, how many feet will it travel in 360 seconds? Other people were primed to think in terms of feelings. Please write down one word to describe how you feel when you hear the word baby. Then, both groups were given the Rukia letter. And confirming the researcher's theory, the analytically primed people gave less. When people were primed to feel before they read about Rukia, they gave $2.34, about the same as before. But when they were primed to calculate before they read about Rukia, they gave $1.26. These results are shocking. The mere act of calculation reduced people's charity. Once we put on our analytical hat, we react to emotional appeals differently. We hinder our ability to feel. In the last chapter, we discussed how to convince people that our ideas are credible, how to make them believe. Belief counts for a lot, but belief isn't enough. For people to take action, they have to care. Everyone believes there is tremendous human suffering in Africa. There's no doubt about the facts. But belief does not necessarily make people care enough to act. Everyone believes that eating lots of fatty foods leads to health problems. There's no doubt about the facts. But the belief does not make people care enough to act. Charities have long since figured out the Mother Teresa effect. They know that donors respond better to individuals than to abstract causes. You don't give to African poverty. You sponsor a specific child. In fact, the idea of sponsoring a child as a charitable hook dates back to the 1950s, when a young Christian minister encouraged Americans to sponsor needy Korean orphans. The concept works with animals, too. At Farm Sanctuary, a nonprofit organization that fights to reduce cruel treatment of farm animals, donors can adopt a chicken, $10 per month, a goat, $25, or a cow, $50. No one wants to donate to the general administrative fund of a charity. It's easy to understand intellectually why general funds would be needed. Someone's got to buy the staples. But it's hard to generate a lot of passion for office supplies. Charities have learned how to arouse sympathy and compassion in donors. And thank goodness they're good at it because their skills ease a lot of suffering. But making people care isn't something that only charities need to do. Managers have to make people care enough to work long and hard on complex tasks. Teachers have to make students care about literature. Activists have to make people care about city council initiatives. This chapter tackles the emotional component of stickiness. But it's not about pushing people's emotional buttons, like some kind of movie tearjerker. Rather, the goal of making messages emotional is to make people care. Feelings inspire people to act. As an example, most teenagers believe that cigarette smoking is dangerous. There is no credibility problem with that message. Yet, teenagers still take up smoking. So how do you transform their belief into action? You have to make them care. And in 1998, someone finally figured out how to do that. The truth. The commercial starts with a shot of a city street in New York City. The footage is video, not film. It's a bit dark, a bit unprofessional. It feels like a documentary, not a commercial. A caption flashes at the bottom of the screen. Outside the headquarters of a major tobacco company. An 18-wheeler pulls up in front of the building, and a group of teenagers jump out. The teens begin to unload long white sacks marked body bag. They stack the bags on top of one another near the edge of the building. As the commercial progresses, the pile of body bags gets bigger and bigger. By the end of the ad, there are hundreds of bags in the pile. One of the teams shouts at the building through a megaphone, "Do you know how many people tobacco kills every day?" The daily death toll is revealed to be 1,800, the number of body bags the teens have piled up in front of the tobacco headquarters. This ad is part of a series of ads called the Truth Campaign. The campaign was launched by the American Legacy Foundation, which was formed in November 1998 after 46 state attorneys general settled a lawsuit against major U.S. tobacco companies. You can't watch the truth ads without getting angry at tobacco companies. After the ads began airing, Philip Morris invoked a special Big Tobacco anti-vilification clause to have the spots yanked from the air. The tobacco companies inserted this clause in the settlements of a number of anti-tobacco lawsuits. It gives them some veto power over how the settlement money can be spent on anti-smoking advertising. We felt that the truth ads are not consistent with the focus and mission of the American Legacy Foundation, said Carolyn Levy, Philip Morris's senior vice president for youth smoking prevention, in reference to the censorship effort. One translation of this complaint, the ads were working. Meanwhile, another series of anti-smoking ads started to run. As part of the tobacco settlement, Philip Morris agreed to air its own series of anti-smoking ads. The Philip Morris tagline was, "Think, don't smoke." Two campaigns were launched, almost simultaneously, with two different approaches. This juxtaposition set up an exciting head-to-head horse race in the marketplace of ideas. In fact, in June 2002, an article in the American Journal of Public Health surveyed 10,692 teenagers to compare the truth campaign with "Think, don't smoke." It turns out that some horses run better than others. When kids were asked to recall any anti-tobacco advertising they had seen, the truth campaign was remembered spontaneously by 22% of them, the think campaign by 3%. What's particularly striking about this statistic is that when the kids were prompted with information from the campaigns, more than 70% of them remembered seeing both. In other words, teens had seen both ads on TV, but one stuck better than the other. Something about the truth campaign was spontaneously memorable. Memory is important, but it's only the first step. What about action? When the survey asked kids whether they were likely to smoke a cigarette during the next year, those who were exposed to the truth campaign were 66% less likely to smoke. Those who were exposed to "Think, don't smoke" were 36% more likely to smoke. Tobacco execs must have taken the news quite hard. It wasn't just surveys that registered the difference. A study measured teen smoking in Florida, where the truth campaign had its debut, versus the rest of the country. After 2 years of the campaign, smoking among high school students dropped by 18%, and among middle school students by 40%. About half of this decline may have been associated with a rise in cigarette taxes during the time of the study. What happened here? It's the Save the Children example revisited. What is the Think, Don't Smoke campaign about? Thinking. It's the analytical hat. Remember what happened with contributions to Rokia when donors were asked to think analytically before donating? What's the truth campaign about? It's about tapping into anti-authority resentment, the classic teenage emotion. Once teens smoked to rebel against the man. Thanks to the ingenious framing of the Truth Campaign, which paints a picture of a duplicitous Big Tobacco, teens now rebel against the man by not smoking. The Truth Campaign isn't about rational decision-making. It's about rebellion. And it made a lot of teens care enough to do something. In this case, that something was nothing. Semantic stretch and the power of association. So far, we've been talking about what you might expect from a chapter on emotion. Complex fundamental human emotions like empathy, rakia, and anger, the truth. But the main question of this chapter is even more basic. How do we make people care about our messages? The good news is that to make people care about our ideas, we don't have to produce emotion from an absence of emotion. In fact, many ideas use a sort of piggybacking strategy, associating themselves with emotions that already exist. Consider the following sentence from a movie review. Rashomon can be seen as a cinematic extension of Einstein's theory of relativity. Rashomon is a classic 1950 film by the Japanese director Akira Kurosawa. In the film, four different characters describe the same event, a murder and rape, from their own perspectives. The movie is told in a series of flashbacks as each of the characters recounts his or her version of the events. But the characters' tales are self-serving and contradictory, and at the end of the movie, the viewer is still uncertain about what actually happened. The movie questions the existence of absolute truth, or at least our ability to uncover it. So the movie reviewer in the quote above was comparing Rashomon's relative truth to Einstein's theory of relativity. But Einstein's theory of relativity wasn't designed to say that everything is relative. In fact, its actual meaning was essentially the opposite. The theory was designed to explain how the laws of physics are identical in every frame of reference. From Einstein's view, things don't look unpredictable. They look surprisingly orderly. Why did the reviewer link Rashomon with relativity? This reference doesn't look like an appeal to Einstein's authority. It claims that Rashomon is the cinematic equivalent of Einstein's theory. Instead, the analogy seems intended to create a sense of awe. When we watch Rashomon, it implies we will be in the presence of something profound. The theory of relativity is borrowed as an association because it lends an aura of emotional resonance, profundity, awe to the movie. The movie review above is just one example among thousands. Relativity becomes, in a sense, a color in the idea palette. When you want to conjure up awe, you dab your brush into relativity. Other scientific terms, the uncertainty principle, chaos theory, the quantum leap of quantum mechanics, are also colors on this palette. In 1929, Einstein protested, "Philosophers play with a word, like a child with a doll. It does not mean that everything in life is relative." To Einstein's chagrin, the number of people trying to tap into the resonance of relativity began to exceed the number of people who were trying to understand relativity. When associations to certain terms are drawn repeatedly, sometimes with precision, sometimes with crudeness, the effect is to dilute the power of the terms and their underlying concepts. When everyone paints with lime green no longer stands out. Research conducted at Stanford and Yale shows that this process, exploiting terms and concepts for their emotional associations, is a common characteristic of communication. People tend to overuse any idea or concept that delivers an emotional kick. The research labeled this overuse semantic stretch. Let's look at a non-scientific example. The word unique. Unique used to mean one of a kind. Unique was special. The researchers used a database to examine every newspaper article in each of the top 50 newspapers in the United States over a 20-year period. During this time, the percentage of articles in which something was described as unique increased by 73%. So either there's a lot more unique stuff in the world today, or the uniqueness bar has been lowered. Perhaps some skeptics contemplating robot vacuum cleaners or Paris Hilton would protest. Hey, there is a lot more unique stuff in the world these days. But at the same time, the word unique was rising in popularity. The word unusual was falling. In 1985, articles were more than twice as likely to use the word unusual as the word unique. By 2005, the two words were about equally likely to be used. Unique things should be a subset of unusual things. Unique, i.e., one of a kind, is about as unusual as you can get. So, if there really were more unique things today, we should see more unusual things as well. The fact that unusual things are getting less common makes the rise in unique things look like a case of semantic stretch. What we used to call unusual, we now stretch and call unique. So where's the emotion in relativity and in unique? Here's the punchline. The most basic way to make people care is to form an association between something they don't yet care about and something they do care about. We all naturally practice the tactic of association. What relativity and unique teach us is that in using associations, we can overuse colors. Over time, associations get overused and become diluted in value. People end up saying things like, "This is really, truly unique." The superlatives of one generation, groovy, awesome, cool, fat, fade over time because they've been associated with too many things. When you hear your father call something cool, coolness loses its punch. When your finance professor starts using the word dude, you must eliminate the word from your vocabulary. Using associations, then, is an arms race of sorts. The other guy builds a missile, so you have to build too. If he's unique, you've got to be super unique. This emotional association arms race creates problems for people who are trying to make others care. In fact, as we'll see, the arms race essentially bankrupted the term sportsmanship. Fighting semantic stretch. The case of sportsmanship. In the last chapter, we discussed the coaching seminars held by Jim Thompson, the founder of the Positive Coaching Alliance, PCA. Since 1988, when he founded the PCA, Thompson has struggled with an important problem. How do you clean up the bad behavior often associated with youth sports? In grappling with this problem, Thompson had to confront the issue of semantic stretch. The tennis player John McEnroe was once the poster child of poor sportsmanship with his racket throwing and bratty arguments with officials. But today, McEnroe's behavior wouldn't raise an eyebrow at many youth sports games. Bad behavior is now common not only among athletes, but also among parents and other spectators. According to the National Alliance for Youth Sports, nearly 15% of youth sports games involved a confrontation between parents or coaches and officials, up from 5% a few years ago. Sportsmanship was once a powerful idea in athletics, but Thompson felt that it had become a weak term. Sportsmanship trophies are seen as consolation prizes for losers, he says. One woman told Thompson that her high school basketball coach said that if his players ever won a sportsmanship trophy, they'd have to run laps. Thompson adds, "Sportsmanship seems like it is mostly about not doing something bad. Don't yell at officials. Don't break the rules. But it's not enough to simply refuse to do bad things. We need to expect much more of participants in youth sports. Unfortunately, be a good sport is not the rallying cry that we need to transform youth sports." Everyone enjoys hearing about real examples of good sportsmanship. Thompson uses the example of Lance Armstrong, who reacted unexpectedly when one of his chief opponents, Jan Ullrich, crashed during the Tour de France. Instead of taking advantage of this lucky break to increase his lead, Armstrong slowed down and waited for Ullrich to remount. He later said that he rode better when he was competing with a great athlete like Ullrich. That's sportsmanship. Thompson knew that people still admired the underlying ideals of sportsmanship. Parents did want their kids to learn respect and manners from athletics. Coaches did want to be mentors, not just victorious taskmasters. Kids did want their teams to be respected by others. All three groups sometimes slipped up and acted like jerks. But Thompson saw that the need and the desire for sportsmanship remained. even though the term sportsmanship had lost its ability to motivate good behavior. Sportsmanship had been stretched too far. Like relativity, it had migrated far afield from its original